Our actor who plays Eduardo Saverin, Andrew Garfield. The star of our film plays the Mark Zuckerberg character, Jesse Eisenberg. The Sean Parker character, Justin Timberlake. And Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, Armie Hammer. And as I mentioned before, please wait till you're handed a mic to ask a question. Thank you. All right, we're ready for questions. Please raise your hand.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Jack Rieker from showbizcafe.com. This question is targeted to Mr. Armie Hammer and Mr. Aaron Sorkin. I believe, Armie, that you probably delivered one of the best lines of the movie last night. If you can, you know...
6'5", 220, there's two of me, that one. Yeah.
Right. If you could please talk about the... that line and about Mr. Sorkin's great screenplay and dialogue and how great it was to be able to utter his words. And Mr. Sorkin, could you please talk a little bit about that specific line, the way Mr. Hammer delivered that that scene?
Sure. I mean, it was a treat to be given words like Aaron wrote, to be able to say those and kind of make them your own and bring them to life. It was amazing. It was like being given a beautiful piano concerto and you knew if you played it right, because at the end of the scene, just it had that musicality to it. And even if you dropped one word or left one syllable out, it would be like hitting an off note on a great piano piece. So it was something that we were all really careful to kind of live by, and it was just a treat to be able to say his words.
And I thought Armie was terrific. There's a temptation on the part of lesser actors when they see a line in the script that they like to just overswing, that this is a line and I'm just going to crush it, and of course by doing that they're going to stomp on it. And Armie and no one here ever had that temptation, and that's just great actor's instincts.
Next question will be right here.
Hi, this is for any of the actors on the panel, in particular Jesse. If you could meet Mark Zuckerberg and speak with him, what would you say to him and where would you like to go? And the second part of the question is for Aaron. If you could just talk a little bit about your great cameo in the movie, like whose idea was it?
Thank you, finally.
Yeah. I'd like to go to Johnny Rockets with Mark because I like their shakes. I spent, 6 months thinking about him every day. I developed a great affection for my character and, of course, by extension, the man, and be very interested in meeting him. Fortunately, my first cousin, Eric, got a great job working at Facebook about a month before we finished shooting, and I'm hoping he'll, facilitate an introduction one day. I don't know what I would say. It's the kind of thing that, you think about all the time, but when you probably, finally give the card to Lucy and say, Merry Christmas, Lucy, instead of Happy Valentine's Day. I can't imagine what that would be like.
This is a movie about an ad executive who meets with...
you were so great in that scene. You were wonderful to work with. Such a generous actor.
I did have a lot of fun working with Andrew and Jesse that day, when the camera was turned around and it was on me and they were just doing the scene with me off camera, I could just see in their eyes this look of, it's not so easy as a scribe. David just said to me one day, you're going to play the ad executive. I said, come on, David, let's see some real actors do it. And he said, no, you're going to do it. And that was that. I think we didn't do that many takes. I think I nailed that, maybe.
You were money.
Yeah. So thank you for asking. I think my performance in the film has been critically overlooked.
Next question will be down front.
Since you gentlemen have been thinking about and hopefully obsessing like the rest of the world is about social networks and Facebook, can you talk a little bit about why you think people are obsessed with social networks, why they do join Facebook, why it is up to 500 million. For better or for worse, you, Aaron, have talked about how you were able to break your obsession there and close your account down. But for a lot of the rest of us, we don't do that. So I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on why we're fascinated, why we want to do it, why we want to connect.
I'll jump in really quick. It was fun to see. It's fun to watch the film. You know, there's so many scenes that get shot, you know, without certain actors in the scenes. I think there's a line that Jesse's character has about it being a final club, except you're the president. And I think that's it's a party and you're throwing it. I think that's kind of the intrigue behind having your own Facebook page and creating your own profile, and it's your world. I would assume that that's sort of what it is. As we've been promoting this film, I get the idea collectively that none of us are really that savvy at using Facebook or any other social networking site. Is that far-fetched? Yeah. So I'm pretty sure it would be an assumption by the rest of the guys, but I would think that would be the intrigue. And I think that what makes the film so intriguing in the bigger picture of things, if you kind of zoom out, is that I think social networking in general is still a hypothesis. I find that people are still asking the question, and they ask it more and more to people like us. I don't know why they expect an answer, because, like I said, I'm ridiculously stupid when it comes to computers and social networking. But I think the hypothesis is still, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? And I think there's always a medium. There's always a medium that's being pushed to show us how human we are, how kind we are, how cruel we are. The accessibility and the instant gratification of having all of your photos and profile and everything lined up, I think that's probably what makes something like a Facebook or any other social networking site so great to people. But I think that's the intrigue, is that we still wonder if it's going to create great things in the world or if we're going to waste away with it, and that's probably what's going to get people in the theater. So,
right down front.
Hi, this question is for all the actors. Do you guys know if the people that you play in the film have seen it yet? And if so, what's their reaction to it?
Well, the Winklevoss twins were actually there last night at the premiere, which
they
was...
were?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
They were the 2 6-foot-5 identical guys?
I didn't see
okay.
them.
Yeah. I think they liked it. I mean, they seemed pumped to be there.
And Divya Narendra was there with his dad as well, and they were both very, very sweet, and generous. And they both actually, well, all four of them, including the Winklevoss twins, seemed to really enjoy the evening. And the, you know, it was very odd to see. I hadn't met them before. I know Army had. But yeah, it was very, very strange, that kind of reality. It kind of makes you feel terrible that we made this film, in a way. Do you know what I mean? That those people exist, and it's that their lives are being played out. But they seemed okay with it, which is, you know, strange.
Next question here.
I'm sorry, the real ad executive was there last.
Nailed it.
Good send up.
Hi. So I couldn't find, when I was watching the film, any clear-cut good guys and bad guys. In your opinion, and this question is for everybody, who's the antagonist of this story?
You know, I'm glad that you couldn't find a clear-cut good guy or bad guy, right, wrong, you know, a person with the truth, a person who's lying. And the antagonist and protagonist in the story shifts as we go along. It's, you know, this movie I don't think belongs to any particular drama, But the one that is the most closely related to is actually courtroom drama, where we are certain of someone's guilt or innocence at the beginning, and we change our mind five times all the way through. But strictly speaking, and again, I don't mean to get hoity-toity on you, but just in Aristotelian terms, Mark is the anti-hero, which actually makes him the protagonist. I'm just talking about, generally we equate protagonist with the hero, with the good guy. That's actually not what it means. But he spends the first hour and 55 minutes being the anti-hero, the final 5 minutes of the movie being a tragic hero, which means that he has paid a price and is experiencing remorse. The antagonist, again, just in purely Aristotelian terms, that, you know, this stuff that you learn in playwriting school, which is the person without whom the story couldn't get going, are the Winklevosses, Sean, and even Eduardo, which is to say simply that if nobody had ever sued Mark or Facebook, there wouldn't be a story. That was a protagonist and antagonist in this case don't relate to good guy and bad guy.
All right, next question will be down front.
Mary Park, People Magazine. Jesse, after thoroughly researching and playing and getting feedback from people about Zuckerberg, I'd like to know what your impression of him is. And Justin, I know you said you're not really that savvy when it comes to computers, but what is your online obsession and why do you like spending time on that site?
You want to take one? Well, my impression is really formed more from the character. You know, I don't know the real Mark Zuckerberg, though I was, like everybody else, delighted to see this very generous donation he made yesterday. And as I said, I developed a great affection over the course of filming and, you know, even over the course of doing this publicity tour that we've done. And, you know, I've been asked that, and the more I think about it, the greater affection I develop. You know, in the movie, the character that Aaron created is a guy that is, you know, desperately trying to fit in and doesn't have kind of the social wherewithal to do so. You know, I could certainly relate to that. And almost to cope, creates this incredible tool to interact in a way that he feels comfortable. Because of his incredible insight, 500 million other people also, you know, feel comfortable using that tool. It's just a fascinating character and, you know, complicated in all the right ways. So, you know, even though he maybe acts in a way that might be hurtful to other characters, you know, like you indicated, it's, by the end of the movie, totally understandable.
Scott, please.
I just wanted to, because Mark had raised the subject of the donation that Mark made yesterday, and I really do think, this has nothing to do with the movie, but I really do think that it's worth mentioning. I know we all feel this way because we were talking about it last night. Not just us, everybody involved with the movie, everybody at Sony, everybody involved with the New York Film Festival. And no sooner had it been announced that he was going to donate $100 million to the Newark public school system, a school system, like a lot of public school systems, sorely needs it, than talk of cynical motives were being ascribed to it. And I just have to say that's wrong. He's made it's a great gesture that he's done. Surely the students, their parents, the teachers don't care why it was done. Somebody does something like that, and the only response is thank you, sir. Thank you very much. I just wanted to. I think it's worth us, especially, coming to Mark's side for that.
You wanted to know about my online obsession? Did you really want to know about that? It's not really, it's really not that interesting. I'm not obsessed. I'm happy to say I'm 3 years clean. So.
All right, next question.
This is a question for Mr. Sorkin.
I get the sense, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that you and David Fincher are both fairly meticulous individuals. And in a recent New York Magazine profile on the film, it talked about one of the disagreements you had about what type of beer or what type of alcohol the Mark Zuckerberg character should be drinking during the scene when he comes up with face mash. So my question is, I was wondering if you could sort of talk about generally what your working style is. You know, how do two people with pretty specific visions make it work in a collaborative environment? And also if there are any other kind of disagreements or differences between the original script and what we saw on screen.
Yeah, the part of what you just said, how do two people with different, almost sounded like, you know, the opening narration for the Odd Couple television show. And in a lot of ways, there was a Felix and Oscar quality to it. I'm not sure which is which. It's not David and I at first glance. It's not intuitively the what you'd think of as the right marriage of director and material. David is peerless, absolutely peerless as a visual director, and I write people talking in rooms. But David, first of all, embraced the fact that there was this was going to be a story told through language, but he did bring a distinct visual style to this, and he did, as a director, get sensational performances out of this very talented but young cast. Our disagreements fell into two categories, things like the screwdriver and the beer. And if let me just parenthetically say, for anybody who doesn't know what you're referring to, this was in Mark Harris's New York Magazine piece that I think is out this week. We know from Mark's blog, this is early on the blog that we hear in voiceover after the breakup scene with Erica, that he's drunk. He says so. He says, I'm intoxicated. That blog was verbatim. I excised small parts of it just to make it shorter and to make it make my life easier with transitions. But it was verbatim. He says, I'm intoxicated. So what I had written in the script was that he walks into his dorm room, and he turns on the computer, walks out of the frame, comes back into the frame, puts a glass down, ice gets dumped into the glass, vodka gets poured over the ice, orange juice gets poured over the vodka, and he begins typing. Shortly before photography began, we found out that it was a beer that he was drinking and that it was Beck's. And David came to me and he said, hey, you know, we're not going to do the screwdriver now, so Mark's going to go to the mini fridge in his dorm room, he's going to pull out a beer and he's going to open it up. I said, come on, David, he was drunk, okay, that's all that matters, doesn't matter how he got there, and the vodka and orange juice is just more visually interesting to make than the beer, and it also more immediately reads as I'm trying to get drunk, rather than just you can drink a beer because you're thirsty or just because you're a college student. And he said, you know, I don't care if it was Beck's beer, it's going to be Beck's beer. And that is just one very small example of, you know, how serious we were about the facts. But the fact that we know what brand of beer he was drinking on a Tuesday night in October 7 years ago when there were only three other people in the room should tell you something about how close our research sources were to the subject and to the event. Other than that, it was, again, tiny things along the way, just words, things like that. There, the first draft essentially turned out to be the shooting script. There were just refinements made along the way, but not the kind of we have no third act changes that happened in the script development process. In fact, what David was adamant about not having was a script development process. He insisted to the studio that the movie be made right away, because he didn't want to go through nine drafts and notes from the executives at the studio. They would have been very smart notes, but it would have homogenized
the idiosyncratic nature of the writing, and David didn't want to do that. So we may be Felix and Oscar, but it worked. And if I never work with another director other than David Fincher for the rest of my life, I'll be very happy.
Justin, unlike the case with Jesse and Mark, I understand you did get to meet Sean Parker, and I wonder how that went and whether you gained anything from it.
I briefly bumped into him here in New York one time, but we spoke for probably all of 2 minutes. Ironically, I met him. I met him before I was cast in the role. There was probably a 3 week period that one of the parts of the zeitgeist that is the internet. There was about a 3 week period where I was going through an audition process. That it had been announced that I was going to play the role. So I went through a three-week period of, damn it, I better get this role because everyone thinks I'm playing it. no, I'm kidding. I met him before I was cast in the role of Sean Parker in the movie. And we met briefly, and he seemed very nice, but we didn't really talk about much. We just... He mentioned that he had read the script, he thought that I was going to be playing the part, but at the time I wasn't, and that was awkward, he seemed like a nice guy though, and I just we said hello, and it was in passing. I was leaving, and he was arriving to a place. I'm sorry. No. No, he didn't. So.
Cindy.
Justin, great performance. There's tons of Oscar buzz for you. What would that mean to you? And what difference do you get from...
Why did you just say that?
Sorry. What kind of feeling do you get from acting versus music?
Why did you just say that? You know, I'll give you an example of a conversation, one of the first conversations I had in private with David Fincher about making this film and his process. And obviously I've spent a lot of time on stage, and the rehearsal process for getting ready for instance, a tour is that of, you know, that alone is probably like writing a screenplay and putting together the shot sheet and, you know, putting together a stage production probably takes, on my last tour, it took about 10 months from concept to actually getting to the first show. So it's very similar to theater, obviously, and it's you know, you have a very long, long, drawn-out, methodical rehearsal process because you only get one take. You know, for instance, you step up on stage and you get one pass at it, and it has to be something that has been for instance workshopped in front of different types of crowds that you trust, and the process of making so cut to a conversation with David, where I came in and he said, look, I know that you probably like to get your performance all together because of your instinctive nature coming from stage, and I want you to know that I'm not going to I'll try to be cognizant of you starting to grow tired of as many takes as I like to do, and I stopped him right there and I said, I want you to know that I used a really crappy sports analogy of football, a football team, that I wasn't going to be a whiny wide receiver, and that I came into this movie completely knowing my role and excited about it, and that I was that more of, I thought of myself more as a linebacker, that if he wanted me to hit, make a hit, you know, it's equally as crappy in front of all of you. It's I would do it 98, 99 times. So I find the actual method of it all is they're staggered in how the whole thing gets created, but it really is a fulfilling process. It's more collaborative. You know, everything that I put together on stage, I'm sort of the buck, and everything kind of stops with me, you instinctively trust, you know, what you're doing as much as everyone's offering things up to you. But to get to toss, you know, another crappy sports analogy, to get to toss the ball around with such great actors, it's a completely different, fulfilling, collaborative, creative experience. And to have the freedom to go in and mess it up for 97 takes, and then when you get to the 98th, if it's good and David says we're moving on, then you sort of feel like, I think we all just wanted to please David. So if we did that, we were all satisfied with our performances in the film.
Yeah, thank you. Right here.
I know that obviously Zuckerberg didn't cooperate because you guys wouldn't change the name of Facebook to something else, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I wondered which of the other main characters, the Winklevosses, did you, Aaron, have cooperation from? And reading the New York Magazine piece, I was a little bit unclear about whether Garfield's character had cooperated or not, and I wondered about Sean Parker as well.
I was very lucky. There were a number of people who were portrayed in the movie, their real life doppelgangers, who were portrayed in the movie, as well as other people who aren't in the movie but were there in the room for things happening, who did talk to me, but most of them spoke to me on the condition of anonymity, so I'm afraid I can't clear it up any more than I have. Let me clear up the thing about, you know, wanting to change Harvard and Facebook. That was more of a sort of comic overarching thing. Another, Scott Rudin said, Elliot Schrage is the director of communications for Facebook. He was the one Scott was negotiating. Scott said, what would it take to get you to cooperate with us? He said, don't set it at Harvard and don't call it Facebook. In other words, we'll help you out if you write fiction, but we're not going to help you out telling the true story.
Down front, please.
Aaron, you say that you write people sitting in rooms talking. How do you make that dynamic for the screen? And then as a follow-up to Jesse, that first scene is so patently Aaron Sorkin. Can you tell us about tackling it?
Well, I do it because they're not sitting in rooms talking, they're standing in rooms talking, okay? And that's how I infuse it with a Michael Bay type energy. I got a lot of help from the actors and the director making it visually interesting. But, you know, I just love the sound of dialogue. When my parents took me to plays starting when I was very little, and oftentimes too little to understand what the play was about, like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf when I was 8 years old, things like that. And because I didn't understand the story, what was going on stage, I fell in love with the sound of dialogue. It sounded like music to me, and I wanted to imitate that sound when I wrote. So, you know, I like dialogue that sounds like something. I also like, I mean, you referred to the first scene, and I appreciate the compliment. I wanted to start out at 100 miles an hour in the middle of the conversation so that the audience would have to run a little bit suddenly just to keep up with us. Just doing that gives the impression of rapid forward motion in the thing. And then David comes along for sequences like the one that follows, where Mark is hacking, blogging, drinking, hacking, creating Face Mash. Face Mash goes viral, all the while cutting back and forth to this party that is in Mark's mind, maybe all of our minds, as that incredible party that we never get invited to. And David shot it and cut it, and Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross scored it like it was a bank robbery, like it was an action sequence. So it's things like that that make it feel the way you wanted it to feel, and I appreciate the compliment.
In the back right, please.
Andrew.
Sorry, Jess, go ahead.
I saw the movie for the first time last night and had the same reaction to the first scene that I had when I first read Aaron's script, even though I knew the scene so intimately, which was that after 2 or 3 minutes of the scene, you realize that it's not going to end, and it's such a wonderful surprise because you just don't see scenes not only of that nuance and complexity in movies, but of that length as well. And for an actor, that's kind of what you want. That's what's really thrilling about working with a script like Aaron's. kind of an interesting anecdote is that we've been talking a lot about this, is that David Fincher does a lot of takes. We performed that scene 99 times. He refused to do it the extra time to get an even 100, and it was just really exciting. It was shot on the third day of the shoot, and it was exciting for me to kind of figure out who Mark is and have two nights. We shot it over the course of two nights to kind of experiment with the character. You know, how detached is he? How is he affected by what she's saying? And by extension, how is he affected in general by conflict? And it was wonderful to have the luxury of the two nights to film such an exciting scene.
Bob in the back.
Andrew, could you talk about your great connection with Jesse, and do you have anything coming up in the future?
Very good, very good. Yeah, this is a smart one. My connection with Jesse, I can talk about that for days and weeks and months and years. But I will. There were some subconscious forces happening as we were kind of going in on this kind of rehearsal process, and maybe it was probably just from my own perspective, but I my subconscious knew that I had to fall in love with him and see him as a brother and have a genuine love for him, and it was very easy to project that onto such a kind of innocent face an innocent soul, it was really lovely weird and awkward saying this right here with you, but I'm gonna keep going. You need to hear this. It was great, and I've been a fan of Jesse as an actor for ever since I saw Squid and the Whale, and it was just a wonderful thing to be able to have a genuine connection with someone and allow that to bleed into not being filmed and allow everything to just kind of bleed in through, and we'd share rides in together in the morning, and we'd eat lobster in Boston and crab in Baltimore, and wherever we were, we'd have like the shellfish of that specific area of the United States, little things like that, and that was just really a fun thing. And the second part of the question, that part, I'm gonna be Spider-Man.
Stephen.
Well played. Well played. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, next mm-hmm. question.
For everyone on the panel, since you all acted, Mr. Fincher is known for doing a lot of takes. I'm curious, what's the least amount of takes you had to do, the most amount of takes you had to do, and what was your reaction to seeing the film for the first time?
I don't remember the most amount of takes. I think that's the kind of thing you block out psychologically so you can kind of get through the day. But there was, I do remember there was one day where we shot 46 takes of a long walk and talk before Fincher said, cut, print, take that one, erase all the ones before it, shoot it again. So,
ouch.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was sort of David's process. Obviously, I'm sure he didn't do that on film because he couldn't. But yeah, working digitally in this film, that's what David would do. It was almost like he would use the first 20 to 25 as if they were a rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And if something good came out of it, it was more of a fluke in his mind than what he was trying to get. So you'd literally get to the 25th or 26th take, and he would say, okay, great, print that. He, like Army said, he would say, print that one and erase all the rest. And it was immediate, and you kind of were like, really? Yeah. You're going to, okay.
There's got to be something in there we can
okay.
use.
All right, cool. So we're starting over. I can't stress, and I'm pretty sure this is a collective feeling that it was very freeing. You know, while feeling like you were running wind sprints, which turned into a marathon, it was very freeing to be a part of that process, because you felt like you know after you sort of got used to the fact that that's what he was doing, you felt less. He made a statement yesterday that I didn't cross my mind, that the money for this film went into the time for us to make this film. And I just, you know, Andrew commented on it yesterday, and I couldn't agree more, that how amazing that is for a director to say, I want time for my actors to act, and for me to watch them act, and for me to direct them. He's one of the most brave directors you could ever be lucky enough to work with in that way. But I'll say this as well, he does not get bored easily. And when I say easily, I mean at all. He is, every take, he would find something that was so specific, the specificity of his direction. Every take, there was no question in your mind what he was trying to get you to accomplish, what he wanted to see through your character. And it was, I've never seen someone so hyper smart and multitasking. To watch him direct the camera operator, Jesse, and then myself, and then have the set design come in and move the blinds an inch because he wanted to shield the light at an angle. And I watched there was a 25-minute session where the blinds were moving back and forth. He was like, okay, stop. Okay, stop. Okay, stop. And I was literally like, what angle of light is he trying to accomplish? But, you know, I saw that part, and I was like, wow, those blinds look really good in the film. But, no, I just think that we all felt so free to just, you know, get it out on the floor and mess it up. To find what was great about the dynamic between all of these young brilliant minds that we were playing, and to have that many takes, it was amazing.
I think what Justin just said is true and then some, but it wouldn't have been able to happen if our producer is Scott Rudin, who I think is the best producer both in films and on Broadway, who's alive right now, and I can make a very strong argument that he's the best producer who has ever been alive. And as an example, all of what Justin just talked about simply would not have been possible if Scott, and this is just only a small part of his job, the first, and from my end, the most important part of his job was being my script editor on the movie. You know, I wrote the draft, and then I came to New York, and I worked in Scott's office every morning refining the script. We spent a couple of weeks doing that before delivering it to Sony. But none of what Justin just described would have been possible if Scott hadn't gone to Amy Pascal and Sony and said, this is what's needed to do this movie right. There's no point in doing the movie if we're not going to do it right. So spend the extra money so that we can do it right. and Scott gets listened to.
Jesse or Andrew, did you want to add?
Well, you know, we're asked about like the great amount of takes almost as though the actors are in opposition to doing that. You know, every actor I know would stay there all day if there was more film in the camera. The alternative is sitting in the trailer. So this movie was the absolute, you know, it was absolute blessing to do it, and we're all thrilled for the amount of time that we were able to spend actually acting and not sitting around waiting to act.
And even the more time that we get being directed by someone like David Fincher.
I don't think any of us actually had a normal sized trailer. We all had like just little cubby holes.
Yeah,
that's the other reason we wanted to stay on set.
David didn't believe in any of the frills or bells and whistles of a movie set. You know, usually you have the set is filled with the director's chairs. It has your name on it. It's got the logo from the movie. On this movie, you sat on the floor when you weren't working. There's usually a big craft service table with all kinds of food all day long, snacks that that keep changing. I personally, during the shooting of a movie, I like to stand right by the craft service table. It's my little spot. This was a craft service table with like a mini snack pack of Doritos and a thing of Red Vines. There was water someplace if you wanted it, like out of a water cooler. That was models. It. Yeah. David doesn't like to spend money if it doesn't go on the screen.
All right, our next question.
We had a set move one day, and I saw Andrew like moving the dolly.
Yeah.
It was crazy. I was like, Andrew, you don't have to do that. just doing my part. So that was me as Andrew.
Over here.
Justin, two-part question. How did acting silently in music videos such as Cry Me a River and sexy back narrative-based music videos prepare you in general for acting in feature films, and specifically the scene in when we meet you in New York? Well, we didn't meet you there, but the scene in the New York restaurant is so dazzling and so different than you appear in person. How did you
prepare? I'm not sure how to take that.
I'm just
joking.
Okay, it's a compliment on your acting. How did you specifically, where do you go inside yourself specifically to find that sort of brash persona, super confident, overconfident persona? So generally, how did music videos prepare you, and specifically, how did you prepare for that scene?
I think making music videos, which we don't do anymore because there's no point. Back when we used to make those dinosaurs called music videos, I'd never really thought about it. So forgive me. I'll try to find the answer as I bumble through this, but I guess a video like Cry Me a River that I worked with on with Francis Lawrence, that was probably the most similar to it was kind of a short film. And then I feel like I worked on another video for a song I wrote called What Goes Around with Sam Bayer that actually Nick Cassavetes wrote some dialogue for. He was kind enough to write some dialogue for. Those two are probably the most similar because they're kind of a short film style, but I find them much easier to tell a narrative. You know, if you have 4 minutes, you can kind of jump through things. But I guess it would be very similar to making a short film, and I would also, on top of that, say that writing music, what Aaron says about how he fell in love with dialogue as a young person, I feel like when you read every script that you read is very musical, and And, you know, it's kind of serendipitous that Army, in the very first answer he gave, was describing, using music to describe Aaron's dialogue. And it really is, there's a rhythm to it. Every writer has a different rhythm, and Aaron's is just better. I think that there is a lot of musicality to acting. I can find a lot of relative between the two. And as far as that scene, that scene is just, it's like one of your favorite songs to play in the car and turn up and sing really loud. That's the best way I could, you know, I guess in the theme of this answer, best describe that scene. But it was, I remember reading the scene at Stanford with Sean Parker, and I was like, I felt after someone's tape recorder just stopped. I'll just flip this around for you, wherever this is. I don't know that.
The other side has Obama on it, so.
Oh. Sorry. You're welcome. I don't know who that is. I remember reading the Stanford seed and then it being followed by the is that yours? Sorry.
I think it actually did have Obama.
Maybe it did. Sorry. So to get to the point about our nation, I think that that when I read the first two scenes, as how can you not love this guy? His brashness and his you said dazzle, his dazzle and his sort of cynical wit, his brilliance just popped off the page. I feel like I just walked into this film and said everything that Aaron wrote. If there's any sort of dazzle to the character, I you might want to ask Aaron about it, because I feel like he wrote this character in such a dazzling way that I just felt a responsibility to not mess it up. So.
Over here, please.
As a question for Mr. Sorkin, but the film ends with that statistic about how much Facebook is estimated to be worth at this point, and the first question that popped into my mind was, how is that even possible? And it was funny that the people behind me said, how is that even possible? You know, it's a free sort of diversion, and in researching it, did you ever figure out where the value of the company comes from and how they're able to amass that amount of
The original valuation of the company came from when, several years ago, Microsoft bought 1.7% of the company for $270 million. And you extrapolate that out, and you arrive at the value of Facebook. The value of Facebook has gone up since then. My recollection is that when I wrote the script, that end crawl said $17 million. And in between my writing the script and locking picture, really just a few weeks ago, it got $8 billion more valuable, and you would have to ask someone who knows something about these things. All I know is that Facebook is now valued at $25 billion. But that original $17 billion valuation, again, was because Microsoft bought 1.7% for $270 million, and you math it out, and you get its worth.
All right, this will be our last question right here.
For Jesse and Aaron, Mark Zuckerberg is still really young, and when this movie's taking place, he's even younger. And we tend to forgive youthful mistakes, but in this case, you're kind of putting together what might be the definitive portrait of a guy when he's got, 75 years of his life ahead of him. Is there kind of a sense of duty or anxiety about building this character when he's as young as he is?
Yes. Anytime you write nonfiction about someone who's still very much alive, and a nonfiction movie, which makes a very loud cymbal crash around the world. It's a cannon shot that's hard to ignore. It's the thing that's probably going to give most people their impression of a person or an event. You're very aware that you have two important things in your hand. You have history and you have someone's life. So first, do no harm. You don't want to play it fast and loose with the truth. You don't want to mess around with anything. There have been conflicting versions of the truth about this story ever since the event happened, up to and including and well beyond those two lawsuits, which both reached the deposition phase, where the defendant, the plaintiff, the witnesses all came into deposition rooms, all swore out an oath, and ended up with three very different versions of the story. Excuse me. I did not pick one version and decide I think that's the truth, so I'll dramatize that, or pick another version and decide I think that's the sexiest and the juiciest, so I'll dramatize that. What I liked was that there were three different and oftentimes conflicting versions of the story. So I wanted to present that Rashomon type thing. If I were Facebook, if I were Mark, I would want the story only told from my point of view. But it's told from Mark's point of view as well as the points of view of the people who were suing him. That said, I would never be unfair to anyone, whether they were a billionaire or a pauper. I don't think we are unfair to anyone in this movie. I think everyone gets their say, and I think by the end of the movie you want to give Mark a hug.
All right, that's all we have time for. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you all very, very much.